Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Adrian Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
BRB, going to Mars to do some sweet jumps on my motorcycle.
And all the way back from jolly old England, and now he's got a posh accent, Justin Robert Young.
Well, righto, captains.
You know, all it took was Madonna, like one layover in Heathrow, and she had an English accent.
By the way, did I hear this right? At some point, I read in some article that the American colonies, they spoke very close to how we speak today. But then over in England, to distinguish themselves from those filthy working class American colonists, they fancied up their language. And so what we think of as a British accent was a manufactured thing that started in the aristocracy and then made its way down as fashion trends tend to do.
I've heard the first half that American English is probably closer to what was spoken years ago. And it is interesting, is like I've been reading a lot of stuff like 19th century historical fiction, which is, you know, certainly probably closer to now than some of the earlier periods of time. But some of it, like you read the works of Benjamin Franklin, and that guy was talking our language. And then you notice there is this sort of elevated writing that came about at some point, which is curious because, like, I would say Jules Verne was writing before H.G. Wells, but his English translations of his stuff is actually an easier read than H.G. Wells.
Huh. Crazy.
So, you know, who knows? But hey, we're not here to talk about that. We're here to talk about weird things. But before we go off on to really, really weird stuff, I want to ask you guys a question. Who's feeling a little bit adventurous? Justin, you just went to England, right?
I did, yeah. The capital of adventure.
Brian, you ride a bike, like mountain bike. You eat fire.
I like pina coladas and getting caught in the rain. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm giving it all up. I'm becoming a shut-in. I've decided that even the sun is too dangerous. Do you realize how much radiation? That's a nuclear radiation when you walk outside.
I got a little fun side story I can bring up about that regarding some interesting research.
Sure.
One of the things exciting about doing space research is finding out all the different potential things that can be done in low Earth orbit, exposure to, you know, radiation, et cetera. And they found some researchers actually put some fungus were able to grow some on board, I think, the ISS in a contained environment and brought it back. And they noticed that it had what may have been, you know, an enhanced ability or resistance for radiation and stuff. It, you know, could be another pathway towards.
Interesting.
Finding, you know, resistance for that. But that's not what I'm going to talk about. Brian, do you like to scuba, right?
Yeah, no, I've been scuba. In fact, I was gonna learn how to scuba with my 12-year-old. We were gonna take classes together.
That's cool. Get on my the scoops. Was we like to say we were certifiable together. Justin, you ever scuba dived?
I was very briefly PADI certified.
By the way, allegedly, and somebody can verify this on the internet, but allegedly the guy who created the scuba apparatus, because it's a self-contained underwater breathing apparatus, he insists on, kind of like the guy who made GIFs, insists on pronouncing it GIF, even though it's a graphics interchange file. This was the reverse. This guy insisted it's scuba, even though everyone wants to say scuba.
You know, even Linus Torvald kind of gave up on that one.
He's like, fine, it's Linux, whatever. Yeah, great. I mean, it's on by name, whatever.
Yeah, I'm looking up the just the history of that. You got me going down a rabbit hole. I thought Jacques Cousteau invented anything to deal with underwater, him and Aquaman. So any of you guys ever gone on a shark dive?
I've seen a shark on a dive. Yeah. As a matter of fact, there was a we were in spring break. Let me take you on a trip. Spring break 95. I'm sitting there swimming.
Fast forward, Homer Simpson, high school age hair.
Yes,
you know.
Exactly. Down at not Cozumel, Cancun. There are two things I remember most about that dive. Number one is the water was so clear that the moment you jump in, you just see yourself as being suspended 30 feet up in the air. Like it, I got vertigo and the pit dropped out of my stomach because I thought I was falling to my death. And then we went down and started swimming around, and the guide points off to there's like a shelf, you know, and he points to the left under the shelf where I kind of see something moving, and he points to the right on the shelf and I kind of see something moving, and I get a little bit closer, and I realize the two things I'm seeing moving are the head and tail of a nurse shark that's hidden underneath there, and I'm like 5 feet away, and it was just like whoop, nope.
Dude, that was same. My first dive ever, and it was one of the things I asked the dive instructor. Like, I knew a lot about sharks, but I'm like, what are the chances we'll see a shark? Like, your chances are, like, your first dive just is it. You're not going to see a shark. I'm like, okay. Dive off the boat. Bubbles clear. And what do I see? It's about 20 feet away.
Just
nurse shark.
Immediately.
Oh, very first thing. And that's like, I have a weird relationship with animals. Like when I was doing my TV show, I had to do a thing with like a scorpion, a snake, and I forget something else. And I'm like, hey, what does it feel like when the scorpion's claws bite you? And they're like, it won't bite you. I'm like, yeah, but just tell me so I'll know. He's like, it'll be like pliers. I'm like, okay, because it's going to claw me. It's like, dude, it's not. I'm like, no, it will. Snake, what will that be like? Oh, a couple little tiny pinpricks. Okay. It's like, dude, they never bother me. I'm like, it will. They will. And they both of them, the scorpion went up, clenched my finger. You know, he showed me how to get it off. The snake, the same thing. It was just like, you know, whatever animal encounter I'm going to have.
That's good amazing. Have.
So, gentlemen, so you guys up for maybe hopping in like a shark cage, you know, and maybe doing a little shark dive?
Well, I mean, we're not in the cage with the sharks, right? The shark is going
to separate
us.
Oh, you have a cage to protect you from the shark, right?
Yeah, I remember like Jaws, you know, like that cage that he went over in and Quint thought was the best idea ever.
How did that movie end again? Quint sailed away.
Quint
successful.
Never went in the cage.
I'll do a shark cage.
Would you do, Justin, would you do a shark cage?
Sure. I mean, you got to figure that the shark cage has not gone bad more times than it's gone bad, right?
I mean,
right.
at some point.
The thing is, it's the height of human engineering. We've welded this thing. It is a shark cage designed to keep a shark out. It's not like, let's go to Home Depot and get some chicken wire. You know, it is a special purpose thing. It has one purpose to keep sharks out. So... I don't think anybody can guess where this is going. Well, Bryce, let's play a video of one of these shark dive trips.
Oh, my God. There's a
dude. You got to start at the beginning, Bryce. You just.
Oh, my God. The shark is in the cage. And the shark.
Bust through the gate. Bust through. Watch the sharks going around. They're feeding the sharks. They're baiting the shark. Shark is thrashing. And this is a big great white shark. I don't know. I mean, this is like a 13 footer or something. And it just smashed right through the top of the cage, right? Right through the top of the cage. Now it's inside the cage. There is a great white shark. It lived up to the name Shark Cage. And now they have a problem. They have a great white shark inside the cage. So they open up the top and the great white shark is thrashing its way outside of the cage. And you're watching like, oh God, thank goodness this cage was empty, you know? Because there are people on the boat going like, was there anybody in there? Like, no, it's totally cool. Everything's fine. So we're like, we're all cool here. That was kind of hilarious. And then... Wait for it.
Dude comes out of the cage. Okay, so I'm
oh my God.
There was a guy in there. Oh my God.
There's a diver in the cage.
So he's just what, hiding at the bottom? You just make yourself very small? And be all
he
like,
is writing the worst Yelp review ever.
So I guess like, at the end of the day, if you are going to have a lightning fast, terrifying chance encounter with a shark, right? Like that is just a thing that's going to happen. In the 10,000 foot view, right? You'd rather that like you are at the bottom of this cage where it's just thrashing and trying to get out more so than you are just in front of it in open water and it sees some sparkly thing on your scuba suit that it is now coming towards you, right?
I I don't know how to weigh that, because you understand, like, the diver saw this thing coming towards it, and he had the benefit of seeing this thing coming through the cage.
Yeah.
Had he been, I don't know, facing the other way, looking at some shiny tuna or whatever like that, I don't think I want to be in a cage. It depends on what the shark's intentions are. The shark's intention was getting the tuna, not the diver. The shark's intention to be to get the diver inside the cage?
It seems as if the shark's intention was, oops, I got into this thing I don't know or understand that I want out of immediately.
Well, and it looks like maybe it injured itself a bit, because the way it gets in is it's just going full speed, and I guess its nose just wedges right in between the bars, and it keeps swimming, and it's so powerful that it just squeezes its body through, thrashing through those bars, and then is in. I'd imagine the shark figured out pretty quick that it was in the wrong place, and kudos to the guy who thought to open the thing up and say, like, swim out of there, little guy.
Because imagine if he's like, well, hell, we got ourselves a great white.
And then Edgar's down at the bottom, like, guys, don't forget about Edgar.
We're good, right?
Man.
So, true story, I actually heard an interview with that guy.
With that guy?
The diver in the cage.
How did he describe it?
He is Chinese and was on vacation in Mexico.
And so how did the translation go?
So he spoke good enough English to kind of describe it. It wasn't a great interview, and it was on a sports show that didn't really, like, you know, want to press it, because obviously that was kind of outside of their wheelhouse. But he was a dive instructor in Mexico, but he was back in Shanghai at like, you know, the point that they talked to him. He said, you know, listen, it's a shark. It came through the thing. I tried to remain calm, and then eventually the shark left. It's like, yeah, I mean, I guess, like, that's the thing. It's like, you would
not exactly Hemingway.
You would imagine that at that point you are just on, you're just doing whatever that amount of adrenaline makes you do at that point, right? Like, power, that is just fear, all instinct crying inside and training.
My mask.
I mean, I it's one
cover
of those
myself in a cloud of yellow urine.
I would imagine that you are, you know, in those strange moments, I would imagine it feels like time slows down and you become very pragmatic, where you think, like, because we've had that where you're about to be in a car crash and you think to yourself, you have enough time to think, am I going to die? Looks like I might not die, but I could die. Oh, I appear to have not died. You know, I would imagine that's a whole bunch of that happening, only in Chinese.
So I think it's time for me to announce my new business venture.
All right, man. We've been waiting. Go.
Squirrel
encounter?
So
you know the biggest problem with shark cages and shark encounters?
What's sharks? That?
Well, yeah, the sharks, technically, it's also kind of the whole purpose. But you got to go underwater. You got to go do that. What if we want those sort of encounters, but we don't want to get wet?
You wear a dry suit?
Better. You ready for this? Grizzly bear cage.
Oh, I think that's a thing. Didn't a guy build, like, a grizzly bear-proof set of armor?
The suit, like, they have shark-proof wetsuits. I'm talking grizzly bear encounters where you get into a big cage.
Yeah, like this one. I think we got a video of it. Yeah, I've seen this video. This brown bear goes to town.
This is the cage. So here you go, guys out there. Grizzly bear, like, it's funny. Like, the difference between a regular bear and a grizzly bear is.
Well, I think this is a brown bear. As Nat Geo has
that
it labeled
is a brown bear.
As a brown
is,
bear.
The
attack.
Grizzly has the moon face. The difference is, like, when you watch the grizzly, it's got, like, the big, big hunched shoulders. So this bear sniffing the guy out. He's like, all right, what is this idiot doing inside of that? This guy's, like, actually got food in front
he's
of there.
Got, like,
so
this
is a big bear tongue. Just a bear tongue is going through. It's like, can I have some of that? May I?
Yeah. Now, you see,
he just put the 4-inch.
This is all like a domesticated. I mean, this is.
Oh, I think that means he wants in here.
I mean, of course they're gonna play it up and make it look like this thing is a man eater or whatever. But it's like my dog trying to play with a Kong to get the treat. I mean, they have a treat in there the bear's trying to solve the puzzle. He's like, hey, man, look, what do you want me to do? I guess knock you around? Fine. I want the peanut butter, bro.
The bear's trying to find its way in there. The bear is now on top of it, turning over the cage. It's knocking the cage on the side. And the bear just tipped over the cage.
Oh, and he did that like it was nothing. How do I get him to stand it back up?
No, the bear's like, I see your puny cage. You think you're so funny. How about if I turned you on the side?
I'd stand no chance.
I mean, the problem is, like, bears are actually kind of smart and stuff. So there you go. That's what we're going to open up. We're going to have our own grizzly bear encounters.
That looks kind of fun. He's just playing with you. He just wants to.
Bryce, the shark dive looked fun, too.
True.
If you have anything you want to add to that, feel free. Or you just want to let the ideas just sit by itself. That's cool.
Yeah, I think what Andrew is trying to say is, like, you know, what you want is like to get like helicoptered in somewhere, right? Like in a big cage, and then have some drones come down with, like, you know, the kind of agitating meat. And then you get your real grizzly bear experience in a cage.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the worst idea ever. But if we're going to make the worst idea an even worse idea, then we'll do that too. I mean,
as a potential investor in this idea, I'm confused, because half of the things you're saying are how awesome it's going to be. The other half are going to be about how no one should do it because the bear's going to rip his way right in.
Dude, I think shark cage dives are a bad idea. I had a friend that wanted to go on one. I'm like, I don't think it's good for the shark. I don't think it's, you know, really good for the divers in some cases. And, you know, it's mostly safe. I'm like, yeah, but it's having them associate, you know, people with regulators and all this sort of stuff with sources of food, which I don't know if it statistically increases the likelihood of, you know, sharks getting attacked, but it also It draws sharks closer to boats, which is not healthy for the sharks, you know, as far as shark fishing, things like that. So
training them to think that food equals go to the boat
and no consequence or whatever. Yeah. I mean, it's one of these things, like, I'm kind of like, if you want to do it, but I'm like, don't think it's helping the sharks.
No, so, I think it's definitely not a good idea either, but if people wanted to do it, we could launch it as a Kickstarter. You know,
we could send Bryce. Like, Bryce could go on a shark cage dive and tell us all about it.
Bears need Bryce. Although, I mean, all right.
Hey.
The way to make that happen
is to go to patreon.com/. Well, I mean, there's many ways to make that happen. But patreon.com/nightattack is another way.
Nope, almost. It's patreon.com/weirdthings. That's what this show is called.
Jeez. All right. Hey, everybody. It's me, Justin Robert Young, fully awake and not frustrated by these tech problems. Patreon.com/weirdthings is where you support this show. Hey, here's a show for you. If you like it, you can go ahead and kick us a few ducats over there at Weird Things, patreon.com/weirdthings. I've done that twice now, by the way. I did the entrance to Jury as the politics, and now I did the Patreon plug for Night Attack with Weird Things. I've crossed the wires on four different shows.
Yeah, we can add a fifth one in the mix. We're doing Night Attack right after this.
I know. So get ready for me to plug
the morning
Hotline
stream
Monday on Night Attack tonight.
Gentlemen, you know what's going to happen.
What's
only like days away.
What up?
The Europeans are going to try to land a probe on Mars. And the Martian exploration, as far as probes go, is about a 50-50 chance of things succeeding. This was the Europeans have launched the ExoMars mission, which is the European Space Agency. And I believe that it was in conjunction with the Russians. I think the Russians may be doing the space probe portion of it. But they're going to try to land a probe on Mars, and they want to be able to try to see if they can't detect the chemical traces for life. So far, the only people to land a probe on Mars and have it last for more than a few seconds has been the United States. And this will hopefully break that streak of unlucky Mars exploration for other space agencies, because, you know, we want more information about Mars. So this is, the probe is called Schiaparelli, which is going to use its heat shield to sort of slow itself down to a less ridiculous velocity. And then it's going to have a parachute to slow it down even further. And then it's going to have some hydrazine engines, which are going to provide a rocket-assisted thrust for a slightly cushy landing. And then they have a crushable structure underneath so it can just kind of, you know, absorb that and scrunch, take the impact.
All right. Now, you said these are Europeans?
Yeah.
Because I didn't even know we had a base on Europa. Wah, wah. Stealing a joke from the chat room. Sorry. I didn't know that we were the only ones that the United States was the only ones who had successfully landed probes on Mars.
Well, no, the Russians have managed to land them on Mars. They just have only lasted, the ones that didn't just create new craters, you know, only got like a few seconds of data before they died. And it's been interesting because it's like the as far as sending stuff out beyond Earth orbit into other worlds, other planets and moons and stuff, lately we've now been seeing some success with some other stuff. The European Space Agency and stuff is finally doing some stuff, you know, landing stuff on the comets, all that, really, really awesome things. But it's been, you know, it's kind of hard from what I've heard and trying to get stuff.
I can only guess that if you are launching this kind of stuff, that you have a sense that there might be problems at some point before it lands, right? Like that these are complicated things that either, you know, if there's a problem in it launching or traveling to Mars, that it might be something that you could detect before.
Yeah, I mean, it depends. There's a lot of different things, places where things can go wrong. So, like, for instance, in the early 1990s, the Japanese were sending a probe around the moon, and they could tell pretty quickly that it wasn't going to go into the right orbit, and they just assumed that it was going to be lost. But actually, some JPL scientists looked at it and said they figured out how to put it into a different kind of lunar orbit that was like basically an energy-less orbit that would still let it get captured by the moon. They could still get data from it, but things can, you know, blow up on launch. They can have, you know, all sorts of, from here to Mars, there's a lot of things that go wrong or anyplace else, but fingers crossed, because this will be really cool. So they've got the Trace Gas Orbiter spacecraft will remain in orbit and attempt to detect a wide range of atmospheric gases, particularly methane, as they say over there. And they want to try to find out, because Mars produces a bunch of methane, and any methane you find on Earth, you pretty much assume is coming from organic processes or biological processes. Versus when we see methane on Mars, we're like, well, we have no evidence of life, so maybe it's geological, but it could be a sign of biological. So it's going to be some really more interesting data points.
Yeah, do you remember when, was it the Pioneer or the Viking probes that originally had kind of a rudimentary aspect looking for signs of life, and it came back as positive? And then like for an electric few days, it was like, what? Life confirmed on Mars?
They had a chemical sensor package on board there, and the guy by the name, I forget his name, was in charge of that, still insists that it detected evidence of life on Mars. But it's one of those things where there was a presence of a certain chemical, or I forget what it is, some sort of biological process, but it was too faint enough to be like, this is life. But then it was other indications were, but then there is no other explanation for it. And it just kind of like, it was one of these things like, just not enough data to know. And there's so many other things that we don't know, so many processes that take place there. And so, but it's interesting, forget the name of the guy, but if you look him up, he's the one who was in charge of that package. He's like insistent, like, no, we found it. This is proof. And it's hard because like anything we find on the surface, you know, this is an environment that is intensely, stricken by radiation. It would have to be, you know, there's no analog on Earth at any Earth altitude comparable to what would be like. So if you try to figure out what would life look like, how would it, you know, it's, how would it function? You know, what would its rate of biological processes be? You know, hard to know, you know. So what are the traces of life? We can figure out the basic ones, but in what presence, what degrees for soil?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what, it gets really interesting. Like, obviously, you know, Mars was not always the way it is right now. So mm-hmm. If you presume there was a time that it was lush and had lots of water, and let's say there was a brief moment that life was as ubiquitous on Mars as it is here, like, we can't find a crack or a crevice anywhere that doesn't have something thriving. You know, those thermal vents at the bottom of the ocean where it's super, super cold, but there's a little bit of heat, and they got this whole bizarro life set up. Like, I wonder if, wouldn't it be a trip if we began to colonize Mars, we began to terraform Mars, we're moving in, doing our thing, and then we discover down in one of those lava tubes, those giant caverns that you were talking about underground, maybe there's a moderate heat source, and then there's a whole fundamentally different version of life there.
That's going to be the ongoing question is that in by the way, in my book, how to make money on Mars, I talk about like the different scenarios of like the only positive information scenario we have is if we go there and we find it. If we don't find it, we don't know that it's not there.
You know,
we won't because we can't rule out every single crevice or place that you mentioned. And there's a lot. Mars has become a much more complex place as we look at it, where there's geysers, there are CO2 geysers, and they may actually be driven by geothermal activity, which would provide your warm water in those hot environments. We know that there are glaciers on Mars, just right below the regolith. There are actual glaciers there. And if you have sources of heat and you have underground sources of liquid water, there could be that. You have lithotrophs, which are organisms on Earth that happily munch away on rocks. If you the sun shut down, the sun's like, guys, I'm sorry, Galactus just ate me, I'm gone. Life on Earth could last for millions or billions of years because there's so many forms of life that are not at all dependent upon the photosynthesis, not participating in photosynthesis. You know, bottom the ocean bottom feeders wait for things to fall down. Things are coming out of geothermal vents, as you point out. It's not the sun powering that. And then like these lithotrophs, which are inside the core, not the core, but in like just in the crust, they function without. And that's when we start thinking about where to look for life in the rest of the universe. It's who knows what really the habitable zone is.
Do you think that that would be like the mother of all financial disasters? Like, you know, it's like here on Earth, you decide to make a development or build a building, and then you discover the Barton Springs salamander is unique to this area, and then they lock it all down. Do you do that for a whole planet, or do you just say, yeah, look, aliens going to be over there, don't worry about it, we're going to be over here?
NASA has these protocols that they put everything through before they send them there so that we don't like ruin the planet before we get a chance to look at it. And like, so SpaceX and NASA are, you know, they're doing the red Martian, watching too much Supergirl here. They're doing the Red Dragon probe, which they're going to try to launch next year and following NASA's guidelines to avoid contamination. But NASA's like, listen, our goal is to be able to do good science, good research, but it's not like to quarantine the planet and to never go there or never colonize. We look at colonization and develop this as a viable thing that could happen. So what we want to do is as we explore, we want to get these data points and understand that contamination is going to be inevitable at some point, you know, but just make sure that we get as much data as we can. Not unlike how we do archaeological digs now, where we'll dig up part of it, but we'll leave part of it over there. And, you know, if Martian life is too fragile that any presence of us there could kill it, we may have wiped it out years ago. We've had so many meteor impacts on Earth that have sent Earth debris there. And there are these weird events that happen, too, where bits of our upper atmosphere get pulled away and solar winds can connect to other planets. So contamination could have already happened.
Wait, just by like straight up the sun blowing some Earth air, makes it through space, ends up on Mars?
Yep.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it has to be the right, you know.
Sure. It's not like an everyday thing.
We're losing hundreds and hundreds of tons of our atmosphere every day in that way. Solar winds and stuff just blowing stuff off in streams. And sometimes it forms little bubbles and globules. And, you know, you'd be getting intense amounts of radiation. But we've seen things like tardigrades that survive that. And when we look in the upper atmosphere, when we do big samplings, we find bacteria and stuff that survives up there. And we're now aware of bacteria that participates in the hydrological cycle that actually does cloud seeding. So, you know, there could be our biosphere could expand to all the other planets.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Prior to us just showing up in mass.
That's some crazy trash right there.
You know what else is crazy? Speaking of mysterious red objects, we'll just do this really quick, is New Horizons, which has been another great success stories of space exploration, is heading towards a, quote, mysterious red object.
What now? The what? Who did what now?
New Horizons spacecraft.
Right.
Right? NASA's New Horizons spacecraft is heading towards the Kuiper Belt object known as MU69.
I totally thought you were playing coy, and then sure enough, the headline is it's just approaching a mysterious red object. That's amazing.
Yep. So this thing's about 30 miles in diameter. It's about 1.6 billion miles beyond Pluto. So it'll get there about 2019, which is, by the way, Blade Runner time. Just saying. That's when Blade Runner was like set. So, anyhow, it's another interesting object out there. Instead of just this strange weirdo ball of like, oh, just another bit of ice, it's got reddish surface. They think that it's produced by some sort of interaction between, like ultraviolet radiation and methane and ethane. They call it tholine, which doesn't form naturally here, but it's present very much in the outer bodies. There's so many weird geochemistries and chemistries just taking place in our solar system. You know, we'll find minerals and things like this or find metals like we have here, but there are other things in abundance that just don't exist here. There's a whole catalog of stuff that you can find in impact craters. Not on Earth, but in other places when you have much higher velocity impacts, which is just like forms of quartz and stuff that just you don't see here. And so anyhow, I digress. Strange red object. So who knows what's out there? What's really there?
We have no idea what it would be.
Well, I mean, we know we have an idea what it is.
Yeah, it's a rock. Sure. It's some kind of minerals.
Icy rock, but it's a reddish icy rock.
Yeah. No, that's awesome.
Yeah.
That means it's angry.
Yeah. You know what would be cool would be a faster way to get there.
Wait. Are you talking about what I'm thinking you're talking about?
Ryan, we're talking about what you're talking about. So there has been an update to the EM drive patent. One of the people who's been developing the EM drive, there's several different versions of this. Roger Sawyer was, I think, the first one to file the patent for what he described as the EM drive. Now, let's be very, very clear, folks. I think if we do a roundtable show of hands of how many of us think that this is likely to be a real thing that will ever work, I don't think any of us is in a rush to raise our hands.
I mean, actually, no. I'm in a rush to immediately backpedal and say, like, I don't know science. All I know is, like, that sounds cool. But so last time we talked about this, we talked about it in the context that NASA had done some proof of concept experiments that seemed to indicate that this EM drive could work, essentially propulsion without exhaust.
Well, no, I think the issue was more that it wasn't totally unproven than that it was proven to work, right?
Yeah, and to clarify, NASA, there's a group called NASA has their Eagle Works, which does like a lot of like fringe propulsion research and stuff. And I totally think that is a great idea that we spend some money on some of these crazier things that if there is some laboratory evidence or if we're hearing from credible people like, yeah, there's something weird here. I think it's worth even like, you know, something like cold fusion, which was just a debacle, but there was something to the idea of having other laboratories say, listen, this makes no sense, but let's at least try to replicate this experiment because it's not going to cost billions of dollars to do that. I mean, you're talking to a guy who spent 7 years of his life developing tests for the paranormal and the supernatural who would arguably say does not believe any of that is real. But
if it was, it would be like the most revolutionary thing ever.
Yeah, we can't, you know, that we get into this sort of weird thing. And I hear this sort of, I see this in stuff that talks about a lot of things like, well, science says this. And like, science does not say anything. If science is telling you something, you're hearing voices in your head. You know, science is a process.
Right.
And you can say, you know, people who've done this process and come up with very convincing evidence or say this. But when people start using the word science as an argument from authority, it's very frustrating because it is not. It is the most brilliant process ever for figuring out how things work. But it is not this declarative, firm, case closed, argument over book of knowledge.
Right.
That being said, something as extreme that is this that violates our basic physical laws as we understand them, you know, needs to kind of be proven to work before you say, let's throw out what we know or believe.
Sure.
Okay. So what's the news here?
The news is that the patents from the guy who had this idea, he's been working on it a few decades, just released. And patents, of course, are public. And so you can actually
We had patents before. He did an update.
Got it.
Yeah, he first filed his first like back in 2000. So he added now like a superconducting plate to it.
So who wants to make a bet? You think this is the real deal or no go?
I mean, my bet is do I think that this thing is a real thing that will function? My bet is no. Am I all for some credible researchers spending some time looking into it? 100%.
You know, this is one of the things. I'm going to give you a preview as to what my pick is going to be, because I'm reading Nassim Nicholas Taleb's latest book, Anti-Fragile, and he talks about how evolution and biology is an individual life is fragile, and that it will die, you know, if it's in the wrong place, wrong conditions, and so on. But the system of population, the genetic code, is extremely anti-fragile, in that every time a unit dies, an individual person dies, that is injecting information into the system that is causing the population to get more robust and stronger and anti-fragile, as he calls it. It occurs to me that science is much the same way. Like, this may be complete crankery, but it is good for science as a whole that this is being pursued, because in the event something that it is a breakthrough, that's great. And if it's not a breakthrough, there's going to be still even more that will be learned as a result of it.
Yeah, we have to, you know, there's the dangerous area of crank stuff that's been pretty well debunked, that people keep pushing forward and, you know, developing conspiracy theories and stuff of why this hasn't been accepted, all that. And there's a danger of spending too many resources on chasing down everything like that. But to outright say no to something because it violates our theoretical framework is not a good policy. If somebody says, hey, we push theoretical boundaries and we find outlier data. And the question is the outlier data credible or not? And if you can replicate this relatively easily, then let's do it. You know, people are doing.
This whole situation has become, you know, the EM drive has become famous because it seems to be something that is not easily, but something that violates obviously are the tenets of how we understand the universe, and yet it's hung around. And there is, I think, mm-hmm. but we've waited for the shoe to drop on EM drive doesn't work. Like, and yet that story has not come, and now there is continued kind of fame derived from that. Like that'd be a safe way to describe this, right?
Yeah, and there are some things like, dude, our universe is weird. You ever heard of like the idea of TARDIS regions?
TARDIS regions? No. Are they named for the Doctor Yes. Who TARDIS? Wow.
One of the theories behind dark energy and the reason why our universe continues to expand is that you might have bubbles of space of the universe that is expanding at a different rate. And some of these bubbles would actually have more room on the inside than they do on the outside, and maybe functioning to have different sort of within different time frames and stuff. And this is if you look at the theories of dark energy, this is, you know, one of the explanations for where this expansion is coming from. And it's just this, we don't know that this is true, but really, really smart people who understand this stuff much better than I do will tell you like, hey, this is an explanation that fits the numbers as far as we can look at it. So, you know, I'll just go like, cool, TARDIS regions.
That's awesome.
And that's what it's saying. Like, so that's like when we get into like some fringe stuff, like people who are like, oh, I have this, you know, device that puts out more energy than it takes in. It's like, well, we can test that, you know, and that's easily, it's interesting because you've seen, we've had the last 10 years or so, there actually been a couple startups that were promising to get funded and stuff because they thought they had sort of breakthrough. And it's like, man, I want to talk to their venture capitalist.
Yeah.
You know, I got asked a while ago on one of them, you know, a friend of mine who was a VC had said, hey, would you take a look at this? And, you know, I did say like, well, I would talk to this person here and this person here because this is a problem. But it's like, you know, there's certainly a desire to see the rules bent and to find that breakthrough stuff. But, you know, anyhow, I digress. Gentlemen, is it time for Journey Quest?
I believe it is. Where were we last left?
Last left, you guys were about to rocket over a canyon wall as a school bus filled with refugees, plague refugees, was being terrorized by by a whole horde of engineering.
Yeah, that's right. If I remember correctly, the plan was we were gonna attract them, get them to come chase us up. We were gonna create a diversion, and then we're gonna take the rocket on down, right?
Rocket on down, see if you can help fix the bus and get it going. I think it's a good plan, by the way, Brian. Your solution surprised me, I will tell you that.
It's good. It's good. See, every so often I rub the neurons correctly.
Okay, you guys ready? All of a sudden you see them coming up the side of the hill, their side of the mountain. They're coming after you, right? And so you're waiting. You're waiting like the last moment, right?
Yeah. Yes.
You press the ignition button. Rocket takes off, right? Both of you are on it, board, right? Right? You waited?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Now, I'm going to point out that it was like meant for one person.
Oh, no, but that's fine. We're spooning each other. I'm on the bottom, and I have my arms wrapped all the way around his midsection, and just a little joke. I give him a little nipple tweak as I say, go for liftoff.
But then I actually shift his arm so he's covering my breasts like Janet Jackson on the cover of Rolling Stone. Ask your parents, kids.
Lift off, the rocket accelerates. Justin, your body's pushed back into Brian's deep, hard, intense. There's like trying to form just one body as the acceleration and the G-force is just combine you. And maybe Brian's arms are a little bit tighter than they need to because of the G-forces. We're not judging. It's just a rocket accelerating, okay?
Just trying to survive out here.
You hear me whisper from behind you, like, just like I dreamed. But then I cough. I act like I was just coughing when I said that.
Good.
Rocket takes off.
Yeah.
It's going up. It's going really, really fast, really, really high. And you look down and you see the school bus below you.
Uh-huh.
And you're always like, man, do we like just shut down the thruster and do this parachute right now? Or are we going to try to like just, how are we going to land this thing?
That's a real good question. I assume there are controls of some. Hey, Justin, are there controls?
No.
All right. Well, then I guess we'll just see. It's probably got like an autopilot. We'll just let it do its sequence.
Wait, I don't know. Dungeon Master, does it have controls?
Yeah, it's got controls.
Brian, LOL, it's got controls. I was just joking. It's another hilarious jape from the old gerbs.
The parachute deploys. The rocket now starts to descend and land, sort of nose first, but then it's in a 1 in a million chance it actually lands back on its wheels. It does have wheels there. It was meant to like go across a canyon from like, you know, level ground to level ground, not drop down into a canyon. It was a really, your use of it was unconventional, but for some quirk of physics and fate, you guys actually survived and you landed actually on top of the school bus.
Oh, yes. Wow. Congrats.
And so now we've trapped or at least distracted the marauding gang up into the hills as they try to come get us. We have come back down, so they're going to be searching for us for at least another couple minutes. Right?
I would imagine they were able to see which way. My guess is that they would turn around because we did take off in a rather flamboyant manner.
Well, they had to go into the hills to get up to where we were, right?
Sure, yeah. No, we got a little time, but
They had to go through a winding path, and like they don't even know that you're not there anymore. You just hear them like, let's get them. We're going to get them, right? And so you're now on top of the school bus, okay?
Yeah.
You guys swivel on down, swing on over. You land, just do this kind of really macho sort of landing in a sprawl, just standing there like, yo, what's up? Hands on hips.
Yeah.
And you see these faces pressing. Remember, there's the little boy who was like pressing his face against the window and had little sister next to him, too. And he's all smile. His face is all smiling and people are waving at you. And they're like, you're here to save us. But they're saying it in Spanish. But both of you guys learned how to speak Spanish. So it's all cool.
Yeah.
Hey, guys, I say in Spanish, we got to get out of here.
Yo, locos, mis tocadiscos, es descompuesto. ¿Qué película vamos a ver?
And they stare at each other for a moment and then just smile again and wave. And then the bus driver comes out from the front of it and he's holding looks like a broken distributor cap.
Okay. Hey, Justin, if I'm not mistaken, that appears to be a broken distributor cap.
You know, I bet you a rocket has a distributor cap.
Hey, man, let's turn.
Yeah, it turns out you actually had some spare supplies and stuff with you. You had like a distributor cap. And he's like, oh, guys. Thank you so much.
no, they're sick.
And then the little boy's waving, and he coughs. The next thing you know, there's a spray of blood on the window.
Oh, no. I mean, yeah, we're immune, right? It's not like we just were lucky and never got infected. I have to assume we're the chosen survivors.
What are you basing that on?
I'm assuming if a disease is ubiquitous enough that it kills everyone.
It killed everybody, yeah, right?
I'm going to guess at some point we were exposed to it, especially since we definitely, you know, all these bodies everywhere and everything. I'm assuming. I mean, I guess we'll find out.
Well, I mean, listen, we're going to assume that because otherwise we're already effed.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, there ain't nothing else. I mean, look, let's worry about the tomorrow problem of what to do when these guys are all corpses. For now, I'm worried about the right now problem of whether or not we're about to become corpses.
I say, hey, listen, Padre, why don't you go ahead and hit the back? I'm going to flip this distributor cap. I'll take the wheel. Brian, you grab an acoustic guitar because we got to get the F out of D.
All right, so I grab the acoustic guitar and I sort of clumsily strike an E chord. And then I'm like, hold on. And then it's like I strum it again. And it's like I start playing like the first few chords of the first few notes of the Beatles' Blackbird. But then I'm like, nope, hold on. And then I do it again. And then I pause awkwardly, and I'm like, hold on, I used to know this. And then I keep on plucking the same things over and over again. Never quite getting it down, but hoping that I'm going to get it.
Even in the fictional scenario, even in this, anything in that, we just landed on the bus with Evel Knievel's rocket, and you can't figure out how to play Blackbird.
Well, I mean, it's just, I used to, back in college, I knew it really good, right? But now, I mean, look, I just got off of a rocket. I'm a little bit frazzled. Okay.
Brian's still explaining to me how he used to know it really, really well. He swears, as we pull out with the bus away from back onto the where we remember the main highway to be.
All right, so you're towing the rocket vehicle. The rocket vehicle's on top. You strapped it down to the top of the bus.
Yeah.
So you're all in the bus driving along, right? Hightail it away. You find a highway. You do some dodge and turns. You're getting around there, and finally, this guy comes running from the back, and he's wearing like doctor scrubs. And you're like, oh, finally a doctor. And you notice, but actually, there's like little cats and dogs. He may be a vet. You know, you haven't asked him.
So when you say Dr. Scrubs, you're not saying he's wearing the skin of a man who was once Dr. Scrubs. You're saying he's wearing appropriate gear for a doctor.
Yeah.
We'll assume that. We'll go that way. Yeah. So he's like, guys, so God, we've been hoping to find you. We heard about you. We've been listening to your podcast that you've been doing. It's really, really good stuff. We tried to go to Patreon, but like doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, no, that's a problem.
He's like, listen, I don't know if you noticed this, but the people here are don't mind me. I always had this cough. It's good.
Sure.
He's like, oh, the blood's come out of his nose, his mouth. Like, yeah, I just some gum disease. It's fine.
Sure. I look in my rucksack to see if I have any limes to give him. Maybe it's scurvy. But then yeah. I realize that it's presumptuous for me to try to diagnose Dr. Scrubs.
Yeah, okay, he's like, Brian, so that's very presumptuous of you, but I will have that lime. And he bites the lime. He's like, ah, it stings my gums, the citric acid. Why would you do that to me? So he's like, listen, these people are in bad shape, but I need your help.
Well, sure. I mean, we just
like,
rescued
listen,
you.
Listen, as you like to say, huddle up, okay?
All right.
We do like to say that. That's it. Hey, Justin, do you want to say it or should I?
It's a no, class. Dr. Scrubs said this.
Dr. Scrubs, no, he's doing the bit. Go ahead, DS. What's shaking?
He's like, listen, guys, so I don't think everybody here is going to be able to make it. In fact, I don't know if anybody here is going to make it, but there's a way we can improve their odds.
Go on.
Mm-hmm.
Blood donation.
Oh, like you want some of our blood?
Yeah, I do. Well, I'm going to need a lot of blood.
Like
how much is the lot here, dude?
Depends. The more you give, the more I can save.
Yeah. All right, real quick, Justin, take a look at the gas indicator. Or what's the gas indicator at? Like, are we sure we're free? Like, we're just on the road. We're mobile.
Yeah, I take a look at the gas indicator.
On the bus.
Yeah. What does it read?
Wait, you're like three quarters of a tank. They filled it up. You're good.
All right. Okay. All right. So it seems like, yeah, you know what? Go ahead and just tap a vein, go to town, take as much as you can. Go for it.
You want to know what, Brian? Great call. Brian's going to be the blood guy. I'm going to be the driver. So you go ahead, Brian. You go ahead and give. You're the real MVP. That's what I like to say. So I'm.
The driver's like, no, I'm good. I've been driving this bus since South America.
Oh, no, this is great. That's double the blood. We've got clean blood.
Here, see, the problem is that you never know. That driver, I've seen him coughing, too. I bet you need some of that Brian blood. BP is what I like to call it. That's what he's like, got it on all of his shirts.
Let's start with the first withdrawal. See that little girl who just passed out while you're trying to tune your guitar?
Yeah.
Let's start with her. Let's start with her. You owe it to her, at least.
Yeah. All right, Brian, go give that blood.
I squeeze a vein and then like I take some iPod earbuds and make a tourniquet. And I'm like, go for it, DS.
The doctor says, let me get my medical bag. And he goes over and he grabs a paper shopping bag.
Yeah.
It's the apocalypse. Not even a clean one. Yeah, there are stains on there.
We're all doing our best. He pulls out a Philly cheesesteak and starts all right. eating.
Hey, Brian.
What?
Huddle up real quick.
Oh, man, that's what we say. Hey, what's up?
I don't think this is a real doctor.
I mean, no, look, and I'm not a real podcaster.
His name is Dr. Scrubs.
I know, but come on. Like, we're all stepping outside our...
Let's just real quick pretend like this is still going to happen. I'm going to run interference real quick, okay? All right? Hey, Dr. Scrubs. I love doctors. Where did you go to medical school?
Well, I started medical school actually in North Carolina, actually, honest with you.
Oh, whereabouts?
Chapel Hill.
That's that sounds like a place
in Chapel Hill.
Pardon me?
What school is in Chapel Hill?
Well, I was pre-med. I mean, I wasn't like full-on med. I mean, I'm not really a doctor, guys. I mean, I was like a relief worker, an aid worker, like helping stuff, like the, you know. You know, I had the scrub.
Where were you relieving?
I'm rooting around in his bag looking for like maybe a scalpel or something and maybe a mayonnaise jar.
Scalpels, it's rusty, some syringes. He pulls out the syringe. He's like, dude, I'll help you. Here's the syringe.
Oh, thank you.
Hold on, okay. Let me wipe this off on my shirt. And he wipes the needle off on his shirt.
All right, hey, Dr. Scrubs, listen, number one, I'm not going to let you puncture my friend here.
Oh, no, yeah, no, I'll do it for him. It's fine. They need the blood, Justin.
No, Brian. We don't even know whether or not this wackadoodle here actually knows that your blood's going to save that little girl.
Well, and actually, he didn't really explain what he was going to do with the blood. Hey, Dr. Scrubs, what were you going to do with my blood?
Well, I'm glad you asked that. What I'm going to do with your blood, find out next time on Journey Force.
He also didn't ask what your blood type is, which is pretty...
Well, yeah, but we don't know what process he was doing. Maybe he just needs to refine some antigens or something.
Maybe he also just remembers that famous Night Attack bit where we talked about our blood type.
Yeah, they're big fans. Sure. He was like, gentlemen, I listened to Night Attack 72. Brian's O positive.
I'm O positive. It's time for picks.
Yeah. Ooh.
Yeah, my pick is Nassim Taleb's latest Anti-Fragile, which he goes to great pains to explain. Like, apparently you could tell he was trying this idea on a bunch of people, and they all were like, well, the opposite of fragile is robust. And he's like, no, robust means you're indifferent to stresses. Anti-Fragile means you actually benefit from stresses. And basically, you know, think about, like, the way your muscles get stronger as a result of the fractures and destruction that happens when you are working out, or the way a tree is actually made stronger by the stress of the branches and the wind and all that stuff.
What is the name of the author there?
Nassim Nicholas Taleb.
I think when it comes to Taleb's writing and his inability to write a book where he doesn't make up a term, he is a black swan.
There is a Wall Street Journal review of this book by none other than Mr. Matt Ridley.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, he mentions Matt Ridley in there at some point.
Fix is in.
The fix, yeah. Old big word cabal comes together to force feed us another idea.
I'm actually really excited to read this because I very much enjoyed the Black Swan, and that was very much, I think, a book. You know, it's similar to Wisdom of the Crowds and Freakonomics that was like very much of its era to kind of define a style of writing that I very much enjoy.
Yeah. Although they do something that I've never experienced in an Audible book before. They have the parts where he curses, but they bleep the cursing. So when when he says BS, it's bull bleep. And then and I'm just like, well, did he write that? Is that in the book or not? Or
wow, that's weird.
Yeah.
I've definitely heard a lot of cursing in a lot of different ways in a lot of Audible books.
Yeah.
Huh. Well, I'll be.
What about you guys?
I'm going to just do a quick side, though. So Nassim is a very interesting guy, but, you know, he was supposed to get into a debate with Ronald Bailey about GMO, and then he backed out of it. He calling Nick Gillespie an idiot and whatnot. So he's got a very interesting ideas, but he's a man with many opinions.
Oh, yeah, dude.
Hey, what? An academic that has thin skin and embarrasses himself by way of social mores? No, I've seen everything.
Yeah, he's very anti-GMO. I don't know. I don't think the book doesn't touch on GMO stuff, does it?
I haven't gotten there, but it is funny because what you just said, Justin, literally was in the chapter that I just finished where he talks about, like, academics, they all have a scarcity mentality and they're all thin-skinned and they have grudges and blah, blah, blah. Who needs these jerks?
Yeah.
But then he also was talking about how big and buff he is now, like, because somebody was saying intimidating stuff. It's, I don't know. I'm enjoying it a lot.
Wait, is it some sort of like prison screed? Like
he has a leg day chapter.
Don't F with me, because I will knife you.
Well, basically, he said like some people are saying, you better just watch yourself, you know, vague threatening stuff or whatever. And so other people are like, man, you should get a bodyguard when you're in a big city or whatever. And so he was like, no, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to look like a bodyguard. How about that? And then he goes on. He's like, man. You know what's a problem is when you're a smart academic, but you look so ripped that it intimidates people. I'm Nassim Taleb.
Yeah. No, that certainly seems like a thing that belongs in a book. And not a Tinder profile.
Nonetheless, it sounds like this on this topic sounds very, very interesting. So that sounds cool. Justin, did I already ask you?
You did not. All right. So I got a pick, and it's not something that I liked, but it is something that I found very, very interesting. I was on the flight back, and I actually texted Andrew about this because I was so excited while I was watching it. It is the movie Truth. It came out last year. And it is the story from the perspective, adapted from the book of Marley Mapes, the former producer for 60 Minutes. She produced the, Peabody Award, I think, winning a report on Abu Ghraib, which was, certainly universally recognized to be excellent television journalism. But this movie focuses on her spearheading of the 60 Minutes 2 report of the investigation into George W. Bush's service in the Texas Air National Guard, which famously kind of went sideways and cost Dan Rather his job. Dan Rather is played by Robert Redford. This movie is to the story that I remember reading about effectively, like, as I imagine, I have not seen Wicked. As I imagine that Wicked is to the Wizard of Oz. Like, it is just a totally backwards narrative to how I understand it. However, I would very much encourage this. If you are interested, especially at this time of year, where we are now, yet again in a moment in time where, everything is very politically charged, that you read about that entire situation and you watch that movie and you see where even in that movie there are little outs given to the argument that, this movie prosecutes the idea that, sure, everyone knows that these documents are fake, but what this movie presupposes is maybe they're not. Just just watch, read about the situation, watch the movie, pick it apart for yourself or agree with it. I just think it's a very fascinating movie.
You know, political cinema, you know, I guess is one way to look at it, and both the books and stuff like that. It is a fascinating thing because those things are they are designed to stoke the emotions, you know. And it's one of these things where if you think your emotional case is strong enough, then the facts don't matter as much, which is sort of a weird thing that we would all say we disagree with that. But then you get into the whole outrage sort of thing of like, but what if the crime is so outrageous? Should we have a trial kind of mentality? Yeah. You know, and that's like we saw that with like accusations of like child molestation and things like that. Like, well, it's such an incredible allegation. Maybe we don't need due process here. It's like, well, it's maybe really the case to actually make sure you have that because it's so charged. And whenever you watch things to deal with politics, that's like, you know, it's whenever somebody says, oh, you know, what do you think about this, like, you know, there's a documentary. I'm like, stop right there. Stop right there. You know, like if that's your primary source of a rebuttal, you know, it can be an introduction to a topic. But if that is your first, your starting, your end point, it's always frustrating.
So here's the biggest thing that I always took away from that particular situation was, to me, it was that along with Matt Drudge unspiking the Newsweek story about Monica Lewinsky, the two moments wherein news media was forever changed because of the internet, where the idea of the democratic masses affecting what used to be a very top-down news media became not only possible but also the norm, and specifically how fast it happened in the 60 Minutes 2 case. What I found very interesting about the movie is that it is very obviously written from a modern perspective. So, for example, Marley Mapes, in the middle of all this storm, there is a scene, spoiler alert, wherein she is reading the comments on the blog posts that are refuting her work. And they are, as comments on blog posts very often are, saying nasty things about her. Now, at the time, and I remember it because I was living in, the idea of media structure was such that the comments section of a blog was not what we think of it today. Today, my grandma can read what's happening on YouTube because internet is so ubiquitous. The idea of a comment section becoming e-bullying is very, very common and understood now. It certainly was not then. And the idea that 60 Minutes 2, which was the word, or 60 Minutes, which was the word of God, effectively, and very rarely unchallenged, couldn't take nasty things being said about it was kind of ridiculous. I mean, in the moment in which that ran, like, this was the rebel insurgency attacking the fortress. And in this movie, and listen, certainly there is examination on the personalities that ran through this. And I certainly don't doubt that Marley Mapes in that very, very moment was hurt by nasty things that people were writing on that blog. But this movie makes it plays it as if it is happening now. And it plays what we believe a toxic internet comment culture, which I don't think, you know, is very controversial of a statement at this point in 2016, was what it was then. So they play it both ways. On one hand, it's like, what are blogs? On the other hand, it's like, no, all these people, they hate me, in a way that I found a little incongruous to our modern timeline. But go ahead and check it out. Truth. I will say Robert Redford, man, national treasure. I love that guy.
I he was great in Captain America too. That was awesome to see him in that kind of role. I have a pick, and I've been working on I can't listen to like things that are spoken word or anything like that. I have to listen to music. But if I'm like doing computer coding or things like that, as I've been doing for a project the last few days, I watch a lot of TV and stuff, a lot of stuff. And, Actually, I'll also do this pick now because another one for after things. We'll do an abbreviated version of that. But my pick is it's on Netflix right now. It's a show that it's one of these shows that it gets the format, gets to the genre, and it's a delightful, fun little show. It's silly and it's so I guess trying to be in the zeitgeist of what you would consider PC or whatever. But it's Supergirl. I mean, been watching that show and it's been a fun show. It's fun to see where TV has evolved to the point of view where you can do a show with, you know, really good special effects for television, et cetera. And it's, you know, the cast is very likable. Calista Flockhart's character, who initially I'm like, this is going to be frustrating, but it's become much more of a developed personality than the whole, you know, kind of the Devil Wears Prada sort of archetype you thought she was going to be. And I think it's a particular kind of show like Arrow and those other sorts of DC comic character things on CW, which is where Supergirl is now. It just fun trope, really likable cast, you know. So that's been the show I've been watching and just enjoying kind of more as I do something else, just have it kind of playing.
Yeah,
it's predictable. I mean, it's you know,
we've talked about over on Cord Killers about how as much as DC keeps agonizing hardcore fans on the movie side, they're killing it on the TV side.
I like the show, but I wouldn't compare it anywhere near like Daredevil or anything like that.
But they're doing a different angle than Marvel has. Like, it seems to be more joyful and wearing its comic bookiness camp on its sleeve and stuff.
I would say in the TV, if we're including Netflix, I think Marvel's the leader there. You know, if we're talking broadcast or whatever, then yeah, CW, because I ain't even going to talk about S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think they're like, yeah, like, you know, my dad, my brother watch Arrow. They really dig it. You know, I've been watching The Flash. I dig The Flash, you know, and I think the Supergirl kind of thing, there's certain cliches that they have in there that I don't think they even really are conscious that they're doing that are kind of funny. It's like, well, here's this predictable thing that's going to happen. Like, you know, it's kind of like how Doctor Who, you watch a Doctor Who episode. I'm like, oh, okay. This is going to be an episode in the last seven minute mark before its end. He reveals that he knew all along that the bad guy was up to this and it's going to reverse it. And we're going to get a big long speech, but it's still fun. So,
yeah. And I think that's the key is just they seem to have cornered their market on fun, you know, like that's something that they do well. And thank God, because listen, that's number one. The point of comics is the large palette of storytelling options that you have in a very rapid installment kind of platform. So I'm glad that if you are going to translate that to a medium like television, that for every, you know, dark noir kind of, you know, Daredevil or Jessica Jones or blaxploitation Luke Cage, that you just get a big, super colorful, loud, fun series like Arrow and Supergirl.
One of the things I really love what they're doing too is I love how they'll go back and like Supergirl's her Earth parents are played by Dean Cain and Helen Slater. So the guy that played Superman and Lois and Clark, and then Helen Slater, who played the original Supergirl. So making her the parents, like in The Flash, was it John Wesley Shipp plays the Flash's father and stuff. Like I dig that, you know, initially sort of stunt casting, but it's sort of a habit for them to say like, hey, let's get people who've already been in these franchises and let's kind of recast them, put them in other roles there or closer to it. I think they did that again. I guess they did that with Smallville too.
Christopher Reeve would show up in there. It's a great way to ensure that, that there's a lot of heart because those are people who had previously held the mantle and now they get to be a part of, you know, the next chapter of that franchise.
Yeah. Well, in Smallville was like his mother was originally was the
Lana Lang
or whatever from the original. Yeah. The series too, which was cool. But yeah, it's a neat thing. Gentlemen.
Yo,
let's say it's been weird.
Yeah,
it has been weird.
It has been weird.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.